This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
For corporate interests. Any nonprofit has its challenges, but nonprofits that do not cater or crater to corporate interests certainly have their work cut out for them more than others. Experience and leadership over the next 2 years will be especially critical. I've had nonprofit experience that will be invaluable to me as a KPFT board member. In addition, my undergraduate degree from Brown University in anthropology orients me well for connecting the dots, so to speak. I have a master's in education and counseling, so I know how to listen, teach, and hopefully raise a little money. I look forward to doing my best to support KPFT during this pivotal and dynamic period. I'm asking for your vote as a KPFT board member.
That was a statement by Nancy Henschel. For complete candidate statements, visit kpft.org. KPFT Houston.
You're listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. Stay tuned for Arab Voices next. Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Mark has the day off. Today on Arab Voices, we will listen to a special program titled Libya and Lockerbie, The Untold Story. But first, I'll start with a mini version of Arab Voices community calendar. On Saturday, September 5th, the Muslim American Society will hold its annual Ramadan banquet. Also on Saturday, September 5th, Al-Auda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition, will sponsor iftar dinner at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center. On Sunday, September 6th, Dr. Ahmad Inshasi, President and Senior Imam of the Islamic Society of Greater Oklahoma City, will be speaking at a special fundraising event for Sheikh Zubair Bushiki. Also on Sunday, September 6th, the Moroccan Society of Houston will sponsor iftar dinner at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center. On Sunday, September 12th, the film America will be shown at the IMAX Theater. On Tuesday, September 15th, journalist Mona Iltahawi will be speaking about the power of social media in the Muslim world. On Wednesday, September 16th, Robert Jensen, journalism professor at UT Austin, will lead a presentation and discussion titled The Color of the Race Problem is White. On Friday, September 18th, Al-Quds Day, the Worldwide Movement for Justice and Peace will hold a rally for the liberation of Palestine in front of the Israeli consulate. And don't forget to view the Journey to Mecca film currently playing at the IMAX Theater, and also visit both the Sultans of Science 1,000 Years of Islamic Science Rediscovered exhibition currently on display at the Islamic Dawah Center, and also the art exhibition When the East Meets the West currently on display at the Clear Lake Freeman Library. There are many other events scheduled in Houston. For a detailed list of all of these events, visit our website at www.arabvoices.net. Libya has been in the news a lot over the past few days, and that is because of the release of Abdel Basset Al-Mighari, the Libyan man who was convicted of Pan Am Flight 103 bombing over Lockerbie in Scotland in 1988. The Scottish government, reportedly with pressure from the UK, released Al-Mighari from jail and returned him to Libya because he is suffering from terminal cancer, and according to some reports, UK officials did not want him to die in jail. Many had doubts that Libya was behind the bombings to begin with. A few years ago, Taking Aim, a weekly program that airs on WBAI, our sister station in New York, produced a special program titled Libya and Lockerbie, The Untold Story. Today, we will listen to a newly edited version of this program, Libya and Lockerbie, The Untold Story.
And Maya Shone, coming to you Tuesday, September 2nd, 2003. At about 7 p.m. on December 21st, 1988, Pan American World Airways Flight 103 was flying over Scotland. The Boeing jumbo jet was traveling from London's Heathrow Airport to John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. At 7:03, a small bomb exploded in the cargo hold. It punched a hole in the fuselage, severed the plane's electrical power supply so that there was no chance for the pilot to send the distress call. Within moments, there was a secondary shockwave, and the wreckage and the human victims from the disintegrated airplane were scattered over large areas of Lockerbie, Scotland, and the surrounding countryside. November 14th, 1991, some years after, U.S. government officials announced that two Libyan nationalists were going to be tried for the Pan Am 103 bombing. By January 2001, in a trial that took place at a former U.S. Air Force base outside Amsterdam in the Netherlands, one of two Libyans was found guilty. Abdul Basit Ali Mohamed Al-Magrahi, who had been the chief of airline security for the Libyan Arab Airlines in Malta. The other person who had been accused, Laman Khalifa Fima, who had been the station manager for the Libyan Arab Airlines, was acquitted. Then, almost 5 years after Pan Am 103 went down over Lockerbie, the Libyan government, in a letter to the United Nations, took responsibility for the actions of its citizens and, in a separate agreement, settled $2.7 billion in a compensation package for the 270 victims. Libya and Lockerbie, The Untold Story. Today on Taking Aim, we look at the underlying reasons for Libya's action and who was actually responsible for the downing of Pan Am 103. Ralph.
The deal over Lockerbie was transparent. A full-court press placed by the United States and by the Central Intelligence Agency, orchestrated in the American Congress, made very clear that notwithstanding the fact that there wasn't a scintilla of evidence that could be mobilized to indict the Libyans for this crime, the United States was determined to oblige Libya to accept responsibility. And key to that was the blackmailing of Libya with the question of the sanctions which have paralyzed the Libyan economy and the demand of the United States for reopening access to Libya's precious oil. Notwithstanding the fact that the Libyans bent their knee, the government of Libya, in the person of Gaddafi and particularly his son and their various representatives, have stated openly, we had to do this deal. The Libyan government and the Libyan personnel had no involvement whatsoever. A senior Libyan source, according to ABC News and the Sunday Herald in the United Kingdom on August 23rd, a senior Libyan source stated, Libya knows that Megrahi is innocent. Libya knows that the accusations are false. Eddie McKechnie, the lawyer acting on behalf of Megrahi, stated that the new brokered deal would not hinder his insistence that his client was innocent. And it's instructive to note that the United Nations sanctions, there are three types of sanctions, but the United Nations sanctions are to be lifted on the basis of Libya acquiescing in responsibility for the bombing of Pan Am 103, notwithstanding the fact that the evidence does not exist and that the Libyan authorities have said, we did the deal, we accept responsibility, but our people didn't do it.
Ralph, UN Ambassador John Negroponte from the United States and Embra Jones Parry of Great Britain said to the United Nations that in view of today's correspondence relating to the bombing of Pan Am 103 and in light of the actions and commitments that form the background for it, the governments of the United Kingdom and the United States of America are prepared to allow the lifting of the measures set forth by the Security Council in its resolutions 748 and 883 once the necessary sums, that is the $2.7 billion, were transferred to the escrow account, and that they have been. Let's look at what some of the members of British Parliament are saying, specifically Tam Dalyell. Tam Dalyell is the longest-standing member of the House of Commons, and he's the Labour Party representative from the area of Lockerbie, Scotland itself. He has been skeptical of Libya's involvement in the 1988 Lockerbie bombing. On August 16th, he said that the fact that Tripoli had accepted responsibility for the attack still does not mean it's guilty. His quoting Tam Dalyell, he said specifically, quote, "The Libyans were desperate to get back into the international trading circuit. It is just a business deal." Now remember, this is Tam Dalyell, who represents the 11 Scottish citizens who were killed when the plane crashed and worked closely with all the investigators for the Lockerbie bombing. That is the Scottish investigators. Because foremost in the investigation of Lockerbie were U.S. and European intelligence officials. In fact, at the trial of the more than 1,000 prospective witnesses to be called, almost every single one of them was either a U.S. or a British intelligence employee. Ralph?
The Sunday Herald on the 23rd of August made this very clear. The Herald stated that the family members, that the politicians, that the people involved in Lockerbie were all aware that there was no evidence to hold Libya responsible, and that, in fact, an expose was almost certain to come. Meanwhile, Ross Lehtinen, the chair of the House International Relations Middle East Subcommittee, stated Libya knows what it is obligated to do. And he spelled out that the United States had put a full court press, insisting that the only way in which Libya could end the sanctions and, moreover, avoid an attack, explicitly stated to Gaddafi that he either did this deal or Libya would follow Iraq in being targeted for devastation. Devastation which would have an impact on Libya far greater than that of Iraq because of the concentration of Libyan both political and technical resources in the two major cities, Benghazi and in Tripoli. There's no doubt that this is blackmail. There's no doubt that the American authorities have signaled explicitly in their statements before Congress what the nature of the deal is. Libya knows what it must do. There are no shortcuts. This bar will not be lowered. And indeed, Ross Lehtinen spelled this out, as did the other representatives of the Bush administration. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, William Burns, briefed Congress, in which he stated that the quid pro quo of the acknowledgement of Libyan responsibility would be the removal of three levels of sanctions. The United Nations sanctions, which have prevented Libya from flying any aircraft out of their own airports into airports overseas, the removal of the ILSA, which is the legislation that the Mossad representative in Congress, Tom Lamptos of California, had insisted upon, the ILSA legislation, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, which penalized any company in the world that trades with Libya and which had frozen Libya from either investment or the receipt of technical and technological replacement equipment for their oil industry and for other aspects of their economy.
Ralph, before we discuss the sanctions, which we will discuss in detail because it is the sanctions that brought about this deal, as well as the threat of an attack on Libya comparable to the attack on Iraq, not all the family members of the Lockerbie victims are accepting the compensation. In fact, Matt Berkeley from Exham, Northumberland, who's the brother of a law lecturer, Alistair Berkeley, who was on Pan Am 103 and consequently blown up. He said, "I haven't seen what I would consider credible evidence that Libya did it." He said this to The Observer, which is a Scottish newspaper. And Berkeley isn't alone among the family members who have been following the trial. Jim Swear, whose daughter Flora died, also said, quote, "The agreement still leaves open the question of the truth behind Lockerbie."
Matt Berkeley, whose brother Alistair died in the attack, went further. He stated, "I will not give up my right to sue. I am refusing this $10 million because evidence will show who was really responsible. And I cannot accept blood money when I know that the Libyans are not involved." The spokespersons for the family were equally explicit. Susan Cohen, whose daughter Theodora was killed, "This business deal is a slimy, disgusting thing. We refuse to accept it." These are people who have followed this case intimately, who have been, in fact, the protagonists and the plaintiffs on whose behalf nominally the lawsuit was waged, who are declaring explicitly that this deal has no basis in fact, and they reject it, they repudiate it. The same is true of Jim Swear, whose daughter Flora was killed, and other prominent spokespersons for the victims' families.
Ralph, Scotland's senior law officer, Lord Hardy, who was the prosecutor for the Lockerbie trial, just before the case was going before the court, the three-judge court instead of a judge and jury court, and didn't take place in Scotland, but they moved it over to Amsterdam to this former U.S. Air Force base. Lord Hardy, instead of prosecuting the case after years and years of investigation, just before the trial was to begin, resigned from his position and became a Scottish judge.
Well, Maya, the BBC report and the Reuters report on the resignation of Lord Hardy could hardly be more explicit. It's called a shocking, sudden, surprise resignation on the basis that, quote, "the key witnesses have denied making comments attributed to them." And indeed, when they came to prepare the papers for the trial, Lord Hardy discovered that the evidence was not as it was presented and not as he thought. The prosecution's, I'm quoting from the Reuters report, "the prosecution's case is unraveling. Hardy has resigned because he doesn't want to be left holding the parcel," as the British put it, "holding the bag when the case falls apart," unquote. Scottish National Party's Justice spokeswoman Rosanna Cunningham said, "It is clear that the insufficiency of the evidence of this case compelled Hardy's resignation. Given that this Lord Advocate has taken key decisions in this case, the fact that he cannot continue with his job and has reached these conclusions raises questions as to whether this trial can continue." In short, the resignation of Lord Hardy on the basis that the evidence presented to indict the Libyans had unraveled and had no basis in fact should have resulted in a total dismissal of this case and its merit.
And in fact, Ralph, they ended up acquitting one of the supposed bombers. They acquitted Lamin Khalifa Fima, the former station manager, and the family of Abu Basit Ali Mohammed al-Megrahi has been protected by the Libyan government. Libya has set up an ad hoc embassy in Scotland. They formerly didn't have one there. And they've found housing for al-Megrahi's family, and they are supporting them.
Yes, the son of Muammar Gaddafi made a formal and statement that these men are innocent. Libya has been obligated, he said, to acknowledge a responsibility based upon innocence. Innocence, he said, innocence of those accused.
Now, well, let's look at some of the reasons that Libya would take this step. These UN sanctions are creating an egregious situation in Libya. The United Nations did a study and produced a report on the impact of the UN sanctions, and this was done under the auspices of Boutros Boutros-Ghali in September 1996. So the situation in the years since then has become even worse. By 1996, the shortage of polio vaccine was extreme, and children were not able to receive the doses as prescribed according to the guidelines of the World Health Organization. International pharmaceutical companies were in many cases refusing to send in medication. Air ambulances weren't able to get the spare parts, so the country's fleet was grounded. As Ralph had mentioned, the major part of the sanctions against Libya was an air embargo for flights in and out of Libya. Then medical specialists and the instructors for the universities and the medical centers, people came from around the world, and they no longer were coming to Libya, nor were the 8,500 doctors of various nationalities who had come into work in Libya. As well, people may not realize it, but Libya has been a breadbasket for the Middle East and North Africa, and the sales of wheat fell off markedly, as well as the sales of barley.
And because, Maya, the consequences of ILSA, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act that Lantos had pushed through Congress, consequences of ILSA are that anybody who trades with Libya, anybody who purchases their wheat, anybody who supplies spare parts, would be subject to immediate reprisal by the United States. Their assets can be seized. They are not allowed to trade with the United States. Banks that hold their assets are subject to pressure to seize these assets. It is the blackmail of imperialism. And as the Sunday Herald so clearly articulated, underlying Libya's capitulation is what it calls the struggle for access to the country's oil. Libya, as the sixth largest reserves in the world, is the eighth largest exporter to Europe. Even with the sanctions in place, the country's oil industry is now starved of investment and starved of new plant, with 25% of its oil-bearing areas having been explored, where 75% are waiting to be placed into full-scale operation. In other words, the capitulation of Libya is based upon the strangling of its economy and the threat of a devastating air assault. And Libyan oil, it should be pointed out, is not only cheap to recover and geographically close to Europe, but it is what is called the sweetest, that is say, the highest gravity with the lowest sulfur of any oil produced, including that of Nigeria.
Ralph, let's look at Libyan oil, because this is really the basis for Libya's capitulation. As you mentioned, Libya has the sixth largest oil reserve. And unlike Iraq, Libya did not completely nationalize oil. The state-owned National Oil Corporation, the NOC, which was established in 1968, this state-owned oil corporation formed production-sharing agreements with foreign oil companies, and particularly with U.S. companies. And Libya, unlike many of the countries with production sharing, allowed in the independents like Bunker Hunt. The other independent
Marathon, Occidental, Conoco, and Amerada had long demanded full access to this industry, which they had dominated. And indeed, they were competing with Total, Final Elf, Norwegian, Norsk Hydro, and Italian Eni. So the deal is to impose American oil companies and their hegemony and to make Libya's survival dependent upon this capitulation.
The European oil companies now account for 37% of Libya's oil production. Italy's Agip, Germany's Veba, Austrian companies, Spain's Repsol, and as you mentioned, France's Total. But we also have entering Libya, because U.S. corporations aren't there, we have the South Korean companies. A consortium of five South Korean companies discovered in October 1997 1 billion barrels of crude reserves. So you have now in the United States pressure from the major oil companies saying to the Bush administration, we cannot let this continue, because you have the major source of oil, of wonderful oil, as Ralph said, the sweet oil, low-cost oil to extract, now being dominated by Europe and Asian producers. producers.
Well, here's how the deal goes down. It was laid out in almost a textbook fashion of the way imperialism operates by Caroline Cooper of ABC News on the 4th of August. Libya now ready to make friends. The Libyans have accepted that they will now curtail, quote, their rogue ways, and they have signaled that they are ready to establish a relationship with the U.S. government on U.S. terms. And David Mack, the Vice President of the Middle East Institute and the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, signaled Gaddafi has no longer been willing to embrace his nationalist demagoguery and recklessness. No longer will he make outrageous statements directed at the West. Gaddafi has become wiser and cautious and ready to accept our requirements. He has become calmer. He is no longer revolutionary, said Mary Jane Deeb, the Arab specialist at the Library of Congress. He has decided to present himself as a statesman. By all measures, Libya has changed its behavior, declared Richard Nelson of the Atlantic Council, of the Washington-based group, which is a think tank for the Defense Intelligence Agency. They have a good record in terms of getting out of the terrorism business, he said, and the State Department spokesman Greg Sullivan confirmed that Gaddafi has provided intelligence on terrorist cells to the United States government. And he said, we are now in a working relationship. Libya will no longer be treated as a pariah state. We have a convergence of interests here. Mansour al-Kakia, a Libyan exile and professor of international relations at the University of Texas, said the United States attack on Iraq hastened Gaddafi's willingness to accept American terms. Gaddafi and the Libyan government looked at Iraq. They were told, you will be next, said al-Kakia. It scared the dickens out of them. And then Stephanopoulos, Colonel Gaddafi, is ready to reach out to the West and get those sanctions lifted. He is ready to accept American terms. And indeed, the terms were made very clear. As ABC's report continues, it's time to switch from the stick to the carrot. The ball now in Libya's court, stated the State Department representative Sullivan. When Gaddafi issues his statement accepting responsibility for Lockerbie, we will welcome him back into the club. It's a blueprint for terrorizing and bullying and starving out and blockading and threatening with total destruction a vulnerable third world country. It's the nature of the imperial game. One further aspect of this, which is extremely important in my judgment, in the BBC News report on August 22nd, Libya completes Lockerbie payout. Britain and the United States had insisted that the country sponsoring the resolution for the removal of the United Nations sanctions, which have been imposed upon Libya since 1992, was Bulgaria. Why Bulgaria? Because Bulgaria had been in court. Because the Bulgarian medical staff, on behalf of American intelligence, had been systematically, and I'm quoting from the BBC, infecting Libyan children with HIV. The Bulgarians were arrested after 400 children became infected, of which more than 20 died. And the Libyan authorities have dropped that lawsuit, and part of the capitulation has been to accept the sponsorship of the removal of sanctions on the part of the United Nations by none other than Bulgaria, the cat's paw, for this insidious experimentation with HIV/AIDS on the children of Libya. The BBC on August 22nd, this criminal conspiracy that is imperialism in the world could be no more cruelly exposed than by this BBC report. Maya, in 1992, on April 2nd, I gave a talk at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, and it was called The Gulf War, 1 Year Later, Who Are the Real Criminals? This is part of Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, a book that we published at the time. And I think it's essential now that we explain to our listeners the real story, the untold story behind Pan Am 103. At the time, the family members of the victims of Pan Am 103 had initiated a multi-billion-dollar lawsuit against Pan American Airlines and its insurance company. The insurance company exposed to this enormous loss retained a little-known firm in New York City called Interforce. Interforce is an organization of spies who have come out from the cold. Former Mossad operatives, Central Intelligence Agency operatives, Defense Intelligence Agency operatives, German intelligence operatives who have gone into business for themselves, offering their services to the corporate and banking world when the cover stories that the intelligence agencies put out need to be exposed, removed, and the actual facts presented. And Interforce conducted a thorough, detailed, particularized investigation of what occurred in Pan Am 103. Here are the results. At the time, I obtained a copy of the Interforce report, and I should mention that this Interforce report, with all of its documentation and evidence, was presented to several congressmen. Specifically, James Traficante of Ohio was the only member of Congress who not only issued a press release based upon this documentation, but went before Congress to put it into the record and demand an investigation. It was shortly after James Traficante took up the question of Pan Am 103 that he was targeted for removal from Congress, that the false charges of his being involved in accepting bribes were brought against him, that he was removed from Congress and put into prison. Pan Am 103, according to Interforce investigative report, quote, was an airplane carrying eight Central Intelligence Agency agents involved in directing the drug traffic using an asset, Munsa Alcazar, a high-ranking operative of the Drug Enforcement Agency. The report continues. The Drug Enforcement Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency had been using Pan American Airlines for years to courier hard drugs, narcotics, and heroin, which were then distributed by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Drug Enforcement Administration in Detroit, St. Louis, Los Angeles, and New York. Pan Am 103 was a plane targeted by the CIA and blown out of the sky because these agents were coming back to the United States unauthorized to blow the cover on that operation. This was documented in a thorough manner by Interforce and indeed John Picton in the Toronto Star in an article on January 28, 1990, revealed the real facts there. Quote, eight Central Intelligence Agency operatives on board that flight, a team led by Major General Charles Dennis McKee, 43, of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Rangers, the Airborne Elite Unit, the Green Berets, and the team chief for Oliver North's CIA drug-running team, and I'm still quoting, is described in Time magazine, quotes the Toronto Star, as a walking arsenal of guns and knives.
Ralph, American Radio Works produced a one-hour documentary for 700 stations, and they also put forward evidence that confirmed the Drug Enforcement Agency was running drugs in Nicosia, Cyprus, and other places, but they were caught in Nicosia, and several DEA agents from the Cyprus office were on Pan Am Flight 103 and were killed. The program tells the story of how two Lebanese from the Kabara family near Tripoli in Lebanon were caught in Rome and the international airport with a cache of heroin hidden in plastic coat hangers. The Tribunale di Roma ruled that the drugs were destined for the United States and that the Kabaras were on the U.S. government payroll. The DEA Cyprus country office denied this, but the Italian judges overruled what the DEA said, quote, the DEA country attaché Michael Hurley cannot be believed. Michael Hurley appears also in the U.S. courts, in the South Florida Federal Court, where Hurley himself had given evidence and stated that 200 informants were on the DEA payroll in Lebanon and that there were controlled deliveries that were set up twice a year. All this was part of the Iran-Contra. In fact, the Kabaras, according to the Italian police, had a company in Rome called Kinex, standing for Kabara International Export, and that Kinex was purchasing military supplies from the early 1980s from the U.S. suppliers and shipping them to Iraq. So we have both Iran-Contra and we have the setting up of the United States of Iraq and Iran to pit them against each other. The police found that the phones for Kinex rang in the United States Embassy in Rome, connecting up the U.S. Embassy, the DEA, the CIA, and the drug runners. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Frau Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Libya and Lockerbie, the untold story.
Maya, the Toronto Star reports, which carried on from Interforce and the investigative work that we had done ourselves, published the following. Quote, a secret FBI field report states, no suitcase originating in Malta where the accused Libyans Abdul Basef Ali al-Madrahi and Mikmin Khalifa Fima ever traveled from Tripoli or were transferred to Pan Am 103. There was instead a special intelligence unit called Korea. It is the code name for CIA drug-owned operations using front companies, specifically Stevens Mantra Corporation, AMA Industries, Wildwood Video, and Condor Television. The CIA clandestine organization was directing heroin traffic in conjunction with Munsa al-Khazar, the high-level drug enforcement agency operative with well-established smuggling routes into the United States cities, unquote. And Barron's, the financial publication on December 17, 1990, published the following. Al-Khazar was part of the Iran-Contra network overseen by Oliver North. The network is described in Barron's as involving Albert Hakim and Air Force Major General Richard Secord. Al-Khazar was the go-between for the transfer of drugs into American cities by the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and Operation Korea of the Central Intelligence Agency. And indeed, the Barron's article quotes the head of Pan American Airlines as follows. Quote, I thought I was running an airline, not a drug-running courier service, stated Pan American Chairman Thomas Plankett after he had completed the reading of the investigative report. You mean to tell me the CIA, the DIA, have been using Pan American Airlines to run drugs over a period of years? My God, I thought I was running an airline. And this report was not only published in Barron's and the Toronto Star, but as I mentioned, James Traficant put it into the congressional record and insisted it be debated in Congress. And indeed, the United Nations Security Council, when it was imposing sanctions, did this despite the fact that the Interforce report, that the articles in Barron's and the Toronto Star were distributed to the United Nations, were presented to the Security Council, it mattered not a damn. Pan American bomb linked to double-dealing CIA drug plot was the headline in the Toronto Star on November 10, 1989. Quote, Washington, the eight-man team of CIA agents was aboard Pan Am 103 last December 21st after completing a hostage mission in Beirut. The agents were outraged when they discovered that the Central Intelligence Agency operation in drugs and arms was going to be escalated. The leader of the group, Major General Charles McKee, decided it was time to expose the operation. One of the people prominent in the report, 42-year-old Munsa al-Khazar, holds two Brazilian passports, shares offices with the Central Intelligence Agency operatives, and he enters the picture when West German intelligence BKA is tipped off about CIA drug smuggling operations centered on Franklin Airport. I'm continuing the quotation from the Toronto Star. Baggage handlers knew the bags to watch for. They systematically substituted them for identical luggage containing the drugs. They were placed on board. The method passed through arrival customs to operatives on the scene. The route, the methods worked steadily for a long time. BKI, CIA, I continue to quote, informed Al-Khazar that he was to continue the drug smuggling routes, especially into the United States and its cities. The Toronto Star continues. And in the article in Barron's by Maggie Mahar, she said, all the specifics are clear. The take from drug traffic is approximately $500 billion annually, funds integrated within the United States banking system, processed through Morgan Stanley, Chase Manhattan, Citibank, First National. Yes, brothers and sisters, this $500 billion expresses itself in controlling shares of major blue-chip U.S. corporations, Ford Motor Company, AT&T, General Electric, you can't distinguish the operations of the mob or the drug traffic from the normal workings of finance capital in the United States. The ruling class is a criminal conspiracy, brothers and sisters. The nature of capitalist power and the nature of the state is exactly articulated by these articles in the mainstays of the bourgeois press itself. The Lockerbie capitulation is a paradigm of the way imperialism works, and the untold story articulates what really is the nature of imperial rule.
It's not the first time that the United States and Israel set up Libya. Let's look at April 6, 1986, the LaBelle discotheque in Germany. On August 16th of 2003, an article was published in Sky News from Hamburg that Libya promised Germany it's going to provide compensation for the people who were killed or injured in the bomb attack that took place in the West Berlin nightclub that had been popular with U.S. troops. Now again, this bombing took place April 6, 1986, and this was reported by Der Spiegel. The Spiegel said that Libya had made the offer several months ago, that is, prior to the compensation settlement over Lockerbie. 260 people had been injured. Three U.S. servicemen and one Turkish woman had been killed. So here we have the Libyans accepting some responsibility for the LaBelle discotheque.
The United States compelled Libya not only to pay compensation for Pan Am 103, but for the discotheque bombing in West Berlin.
Yes.
A parallel and an exact expression of the same fraud.
But let's look seriously at what is behind the Berlin discotheque. Now we've exposed Pan Am 103, let's look at what took place in Berlin.
The German television station Zweites Deutscher Fernsehen aired one of the great exposés of our time in demonstrating that the Berlin operation had nothing to do with Libya, but was in fact an operation of American and Israeli intelligence, and had the greatest relevance to events of the previous 3 weeks, in which attacks on United States embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were the justification for a U.S. missile strike against Afghanistan and Sudan, and, quote, a shift in American foreign policy to an even more unbridled use of military force internationally. We will come later to the fact that the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Nairobi was in fact the work of a high-level FBI operative, as exposed in the San Francisco Chronicle. But let's stay with the events of Berlin and the blowing up of the LaBelle discotheque, for as the German television station exposed, and as was reproduced in the German political magazine Frontal, the operation was a U.S. intelligence and Mossad operation. It was planned in advance. The hands of the U.S. intelligence and the Mossad were exposed, and the particulars of how this went down were set forth by Viktor Ostrovsky in his book, The Other Side of Deception. Maya?
In The Other Side of Deception, Viktor Ostrovsky discusses in great detail an operation of the Mossad called the LAT, which is their psychological warfare operation. And key to it is Trojan, a special communication device that can be planted by naval commandos deep inside enemy territory, that is, whoever the Mossad considers an enemy. The disinformation unit, the LAP, is intended to send messages that will be picked up, particularly by U.S. and British listening stations. As Ostrovsky says, quote, originating from an IDF Navy ship out at sea, the pre-recorded digital transmissions can be picked up only by the Trojan. The device would then rebroadcast the transmission on another frequency, one used for official business in the so-called enemy country, at which point the transmission would be picked up by American ears in Britain. What Ostrovsky goes into in great detail is how on February 17th and 18th of the year of the Berlin discotheque bombing, a Trojan device was planted in Tripoli, Libya. And by the end of March, the Americans were already intercepting messages broadcast by the Trojan, which was only activated during heavy communication traffic hours. Ostrovsky continues, using the Trojan, the Mossad made it appear that a long series of terrorist orders were being transmitted to various Libyan embassies around the world. As the Mossad had hoped, the transmissions were deciphered by the Americans, construed as ample proof that the Libyans were active sponsors of terrorism.
Maya, what happened here, as Ostrovsky describes in page 115, 116 of his book, The Other Side of Deception, because keep in mind that Viktor Ostrovsky was a point man in this very operation. He's describing lived experience. They brought Operation Trojan's LAP equipment into an apartment building 3 blocks from the Bab al-Aziza barracks, which were Gaddafi's headquarters. They programmed the room of the apartment so it would blow up if anybody entered it, and they established the cylinder in the top story of the building, and this sent continuous signals to Libyan embassies, which were indicating that the Libyans were going to undertake assassination attacks and were going to blow up the La Belle discotheque in West Berlin. The French and the Spanish intelligence services, however, detected the nature of the Mossad operation and exposed it as such. Nonetheless, the United States intelligence officials accepted the entire bona fides of the false flag operation of the Mossad and used it as the pretext for the attack on Libya, the air attack following the Mossad operation of La Belle that the German intelligence services exposed and that Viktor Ostrovsky exposed. The Guardian in London, in a detailed article, The Guardian in London, which was addressing itself to the question of Lockerbie on the 17th of April, 1999, and the headline is, What If They Are Innocent?, and proceeds with a summary of what we've described here regarding the false evidence concerning Pan Am 103, and then it states the following. Viktor Ostrovsky, the former intelligence colonel with Israel's Mossad and author of By Way of Deception, testified that the Mossad commando set up the transmitter in Tripoli. They generated a false signal about the Berlin bombing. In fact, it was a Mossad operation. And it goes on to detail all that is established in the book. And indeed, it cites the book on the Mossad called Gideon's Spies by Gordian Thomas that states that the LAP, the psychological warfare wing of Mossad, was in full control of the operation in Berlin.
Now, this was told directly to Viktor Ostrovsky by someone involved in the operations and with whom he had enormous confidence, because Ostrovsky himself was involved in many, many similar operations. The result of this was that on April 14, 1986, President Reagan sent 160 American aircraft to drop 60 tons of bombs on Libya. The attackers bombed the Tripoli International Airport, the Bab al-Aziza barracks, the city Bilal Naval Base, the city of Benghazi, which is one of the major cities in Libya, the Benin airfield outside Benghazi. The strike force had two main bodies, one originating in England, that means the collaboration of the British, and the other from flat tops, that is the battleships in the Mediterranean. These were the Coral Sea and the America. In Libya, 40 civilian casualties, including the death of Muammar Gaddafi's adopted daughter. The intent was to assassinate Gaddafi himself.
And in the article in The Guardian, which is a detailed investigative report, What If They Are Innocent?, it connects the Berlin events to the blowing up of Pan Am 103, and it cites the reported interviews in which it says that Yuval Aviv, the Israeli former Mossad operative who was at interviews, proved convincingly who planted the bomb in Frankfurt. The ring was run by a CIA unit working in collusion with Hezbollah. Is Hezbollah operatives that were in fact doubling for the Mossad, and I'm quoting, and Defense Intelligence Agency sources confirmed that the CIA Hezbollah drug ring was set up by Mossad operatives, and indeed Israel was selling elderly U.S. missiles at profit to Iran, skimming from drugs and arms profits used as part of the Iran gate to subsidize the Contras, the right-wing terrorist movement in Nicaragua favored by Reagan and the iniquitous Oliver North, unquote, Manchester Guardian. And here, Maya, Andrew Kilgore in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs on December 2000. The Libyan Hit Squad Hoax. Soon after President Reagan took office in 1981, breathless articles about Libyan hit squads occupied the front pages of the Washington Post. For 3 weeks, Washington Post readers were obsessed with hit squads reportedly originating in the Middle East, which had reached Canada and were poised, quote, to cross into the United States like a swarm of northern killer bees. How was a group of supposed assassins to be so easily tracked? The question was not answered. Nonetheless, heavy concrete barriers were placed around the White House, Capitol Hill, and the Department of State, where they remain today. The Washington Report continues as follows. The hoax began to collapse when the Washington Post assigned names to police-style composite drawings of the Libyan assassins. But Arabic language specialized recognized these names as Shia names, the Shia in intense dislike of Gaddafi, and hardly Libyan operatives. Suddenly, the hit squads disappeared from the Washington Post, never to return. 5 years later, a two-line item in the Washington Post exposed the truth. Manoohar Gurbanifar, an Iranian exile in Washington working for the Mossad, confessed that he had dreamt up the hit squads on behalf of the Mossad to arrange for the punishing of Libya, an enemy of Israel, unquote, Washington Post expose, cited in Washington Report on the Middle East by Andrew Kilgore in December of 2000, and a further expose of great importance pertaining to Pan Am 103. The Washington Report found that the Pan Am 103, quote, was intended to blow up over the sea, where evidence of criminality could never have been found. Instead, unusually strong gale winds that day led the pilot to fly north to get above the tempest and thus to be over Scotland when the bomb exploded. The real criminals, those who blew up Pan Am 103, are trembling because this fluke of nature left evidence on the ground that points to them, unquote. Trembling they may be, but the sanctions and the blackmailing of Libya and this engineered arrangement of imperialism causes the fear and trembling to dissolve somewhat. The truth is that imperialism and the Mossad and the Central Intelligence Agency are the real terrorists and the instruments of the downing of Pan Am 103. Nor should I mention is this in isolation, because it was preceded by two significant events. And those were, first, the blowing up of a Libyan airline, commercial airline by the Israelis over the Sinai, when a commercial airline was descending to land in Cairo. The Israelis blew it out of the sky. They blew it out of the sky, resulting in the deaths of 280 people. And indeed, they were anticipating that there would be retaliation by Libya, which never occurred. And it was part of the operation that is expressed in Operation Trojan. It has its antecedents not only in the discotheque of La Belle in Berlin, but in other operations detailed by Victor Ostrovsky and by Ben Menashe in his book Black Operations, and on the arms trafficking of the Israelis and the Central Intelligence Agency. Achille Lauro itself, as we've detailed, was a part of this operation.
Well, pointing the finger at Libya has been going on since 1988, when Vincent Canestraro, the head of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center and in charge of the so-called American investigation into the bombing, stated that the men responsible were Libyan intelligence agents. And then, like the Washington Post, he had to retract his statement and release the two men that they held at the time. Later in 1991, they came up with the story that the chief of airline security, Al-Megrahi, and the station manager, Fimo, were responsible. And the basis of that was getting somebody to say that he had seen Al-Megrahi buy some clothes that they supposedly found over Lockerbie. So this is all very, very skimpy false information.
Well, the false information has no scintilla of basis, in fact. And let me correct myself. I stated before that with respect to the Libyan plane down in the Sinai about the number of victims, it was not 270. That was the number of victims in Lockerbie. The operation that downed the aircraft killed 111 passengers and crew members. The Israelis targeted the commercial aircraft as it was flying over Sinai, quote, for a routine landing at Cairo International Airport. The journalists asked why the Israeli soldiers were firing ground-to-air missiles at a civilian airline that everybody on the ground could see for what it was. The Israeli killing of such a large number, I'm quoting, of Libyan and Egyptian officials was not accidental. It was a documented Israeli intervention, a deliberate attempt to instigate hostilities between Libya and the United States. When it failed, Labelle, Berlin operation, Operation Trojan, was set in motion. And indeed, the attack by 150 U.S. warplanes on Libya on April 14, 1986, was the intended outcome, the planned operation, the Black Ops operation itself.
People should realize that Libya, it's a very large country in terms of land mass. It's larger than Britain, France, and Germany combined, but it has a very small population, 4.5 million people. That's less than half of the population of New York City or of London. The prime interest in Libya is the oil. Sixth largest oil reserves, sweet crude oil that is easy to extract, and the majority of Libya's oil is still unexplored.
Well, Maya, to show the relationship between these false flag operations and the nature of intelligence, at the time that the Israelis were shooting the plane out of the air over the Sinai, it was shortly after that that the United States would blow an Iranian airliner out of the sky over Iran under almost identical circumstances. And what Ostrovsky exposes in showing the relationship between these real intelligence attacks on airliners. You talk about hijacking aircraft, you talk about taking craft out of the sky, imputed to Libya, imputed to Iran, imputed to Syria. These are Mossad operations. And indeed, Rafi Eitan, with his operative Roddy, conducted a black operation with respect to the Achille Lauro with the same modality. Linked to this, the people who the Mossad put in place for the operation in the Achille Lauro were involved, quote, in a slush fund black operation to blow up an El Al plane in London and attribute this to Syria. And the details of this we've gone into in another show.
Go to our internet site and you'll find a lot of detail about the very operations of which Ralph is speaking now.
Let me say this, Maya. We'll show the relationship between false flag operations and 9/11 itself, a relationship that the Washington Post made clear when it said with respect to Pan Am 103, the acquittal of one of the two accused shows why public trials cannot be allowed, why military tribunals are required, why defendants should not have access to lawyers, because just as in 9/11, so with Pan Am 103, the country has to be protected from the use of the courts to jeopardize the security of the United States. In short, brothers and sisters, the security of imperialism is dependent upon the false flag operations from Pan Am 103 to 9/11 itself. We'll be with you next week.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. As Ralph said, we'll be with you next week. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net.
What you just heard was a special program titled Libya and Lockerbie, The Untold Story, produced by Taking Aim, a weekly program that airs on WBAI, our sister station in New York. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. Technology Bites is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
KPFT. KPFT has something for all kinds of music lovers, including hip-hop, reggae, Tejano, and all genres in between. You listen to KPFT to find the music that satisfies your curiosity. So tune in at 1 p.m. weekdays when KPFT brings you even more adventurous sounds for your afternoon. Mondays at 1, check out Jane Cummins with her eclectic mix of world music. Tuesdays, catch the King of Grief, Jeffrey Thames, on Sound Awake. Wednesdays at 1, hear Sound of Soul Radio for progressive hip-hop and soul. On Thursdays, Harrison Kumi delivers fabulous sounds from the African diaspora on World Music Express. And on Fridays at 1, join Rhonda Garner for cutting-edge rock music featuring the best of the new school on Radioactive. Today, few radio stations challenge your intellectual and musical curiosity. But tune in at 1 p.m. weekdays, where KPFT carries on its tradition of adventurous sounds for your afternoons. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.